Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. All this week, we're talking about musical guilty pleasures. You know, those songs you like, but kinda wish you didn't. The ones you're not eager to tell your friends you like. Although many of you apparently have no trouble telling us about them. So we'll hear some more of those during the course of the show, including one from last night's guest, Brian Eno. But we also want to give you some music you'll be proud to like, and guitarist Jason Vio is going to do just that. Wait till you hear his live set coming up later. Also, a look at the history of black producers on Broadway. But first, here's a message from Sonny, who is so embarrassed by his musical guilty pleasure that he chooses not to disclose his location.
Okay, yeah, this is Sonny. My guilty pleasure is I like Gilbert and Sullivan arrangements.
I am the very model of a modern major general. I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the fights historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical.
Now I'm a rock and roll guy. I like, you know, hard rock, metal, punk, all that stuff and everything. I'm in my 50s. But I do like catchy Gilbert and Sullivan songs, I have to admit it, you know? Like from Pirates of Penzance and stuff like that.
Ah, guilty pleasures. For a whole generation of us, the movies of John Hughes have become a kind of guilty pleasure. Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles, and of course, The Breakfast Club.
Oh, baby, don't you forget about me.
That trio of 1980s films introduced us not just to the late filmmaker John Hughes, but also to the actress Molly Ringwald. In the last few years, she's published a memoir and a novel. Now we're hearing yet another side of Molly Ringwald. Her new album, called Except Sometimes, is a collection of jazz renditions of tunes from the Great American Songbook. She's here with me right now to talk about it. Molly, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
All this week, you know, we are doing this theme of musical guilty pleasures. Are any of these songs from the Great American Songbook, were these guilty pleasures of yours?
I don't think they were guilty pleasures. I think I consider the Great American Songbook sort of our national treasure. So for me, they're like badges of honor, you know, that I know them and that I've loved them for as long as I have. I mean, I definitely have guilty pleasures, but I don't think
really?
The Great American Songbook is one of
them. Do tell, then.
Oh, God. Does Lady Gaga count as a guilty pleasure?
If you feel guilty about liking her, it absolutely does.
I don't know, because I kind of dig her. I think she's cool, so I don't know if she counts as a guilty pleasure. What about David the Partridge Family? I think
oh,
I love
David
you.
Oh, David Cassidy.
David Cassidy, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you can feel guilty
okay.
about that. That's guilty.
Okay. I'll go with that, then.
I think I love you, so what am I so afraid of? I'm afraid that I'm not sure of a love there is no cure for.
Well, I had two reasons for asking about the Great American Songbook. The first one, obviously, is it's the material that you've drawn from mm-hmm. the new record. But the other is you grew up in the rock era, you mm-hmm. know, where if you did like that, that was like your parents' music, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
And you probably didn't want to go broadcasting to your cool friends that you were listening to Hobie Carmichael and, you know,
Louis
stuff
Prima.
Like.
Yeah, no, that's true. I did go through this brief period of time where I kind of kept it a little bit secret, you know, when I was a teenager and you know, self-conscious about everything. But I got over that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, they don't call it the Great American Songbook for nothing. I mean, there are some incredible songs here. How did you winnow down this enormous body of material?
Well, it was really hard, but I really just tried to pick songs that were classics, that were standards, but perhaps haven't been heard quite as much as other songs. I mean, usually when you see somebody's standards album, you can count, you know, on hearing, you know, Someone to Watch Over Me or My Funny Valentine or, you know, I've Got a Crush on You, you know, all great songs,
right, right.
But just recorded so many times. So I tried to pick songs that are standards, like, you know, The Ballad of the Sad Young Men, you know, and they have been recorded before beautifully, you know, Anita O'Day and and others. And I think that was really the criteria for me, and that the lyrics really spoke to me in some way. And then just it had to sort of gel with the whole band.
Right. I'm partial to the very thought of you, great old Ray Noble song that's been recorded a number of times. But as you say, I'm kind of hard pressed to think of a really great recording of it recently. Yeah. Let's hear Molly Ringwald's recording. The album's called Except Sometimes, and this is her version of The Very Thought of You.
The very thought of you and I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a king.
Very Thought of You, Ray Noble classic, sung by my guest Molly Ringwald from her new album called Except Sometimes, which is out now. Molly is performing at Iridium tomorrow night, two shows at 8 and 10 with essentially the same band that's on the record. How long have you been singing, and how long have you been singing like this?
I've been singing in front of an audience since I was 3 and a half. I started with my father, Bob Ringwald, who's a traditional jazz musician. But I started with these guys in 2007. Peter Smith, who's my pianist and arranger, and Alan Mosqueda, sax, and Trevor Ware, bass, and the great brushmaster, Mr. Clayton Cameron, on drums.
And what was the was there like an aha moment that just where it hit you and said, now I've got to sing?
Well, I'd been wanting to put a band together for quite a while, but I really was sort of looking for that perfect collaborator. And I think when Peter and I met and started to work together, that was really kind of the moment for me. And then when the whole band came together, I mean, I just love these guys. I love working with them. And so it just kept getting better and better.
Now, you mentioned your dad, Bob Ringwald. What kind of, I mean, he goes back even further into music history, doesn't he, in terms of the type of stuff he plays?
Yeah, he started as a modern jazz musician in the late 50s, early 60s, and then he went way back. And so, you know, he plays, you know, Louis Armstrong and Bix Beiderbecke and Sidney Bechet, and those are all his idols. And that's kind of the stuff that I grew up singing.
Really? So 1920s stuff.
Yeah. I was raised on Bessie Smith. Give me a pig foot and a bottle of beer. And
wow.
Nobody knows you when you're down and out. And, you know, all of those songs. I was really, that was my early education. And then I went from that into musical theater. And then from that to films, and then kind of put the music aside.
Yeah. I want to play for you something not from your new record, but from this is you with the Fulton Street Jazz Band. Tell us a little bit about this recording.
I'm not sure which one it is because I've recorded with it. Is this when I was 6 years old?
Yes, it is.
This is the record that I did with my dad with his band when I was 6 years old. Half of it being Bessie Smith songs, and then the other half, I think, are Helen Kane songs.
And so do you remember this? I mean, do you remember going into the studio?
Of course I do. I was six.
Yeah.
It was fun. We recorded it at Skeets Herford produced it, and we recorded it at his place in Lake Tahoe, and it was snowing, and I would sing a song, and then they would say, okay, go play, and I would play and go and run off the roof and jump into a big pile of snow for 15 minutes and then come back in and record another song. It was really fun.
And you're 6 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know any better. It's like, yeah, I guess this is what six-year-olds do.
I enjoyed it. I loved it.
This is a six-year-old Molly Ringwald with the Fulton Street Jazz Band and the song A Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight.
When you hear that music start to play, tap your feet and start to step that way. When you get the rhythm, you want to shout hooray. Be a hot time in the old town tonight, my darling. When you hear the bell go...
So even at the age of six, Molly Ringwald, you were singing standards. I mean, A Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight.
I was swinging.
So was the band.
Yeah.
Fulton Street Jazz Band.
Yeah.
And your dad on... Piano,
that's right.
Wow. So at some point, you know, as you say, you get into music theater and then into acting. I mean, at some point, did you have to make a choice between pursuing acting or singing?
I felt like I did. You know, at the time when I was coming up as an actress, you know, it was different. You know, in the golden age of movies, you know, everyone was expected to do all three, you know, dance, act, sing. And it's a little bit like that now, but at that time, I really felt like I wouldn't be taken seriously as an actress. And so, you know, because there was nobody else doing it, and mm-hmm. particularly the kind of music that I like to sing, jazz, there was no, you know, this is before Harry Connick Jr. came out, before Diana Krall. I didn't really see that I could really have a career. And I loved acting, so, you know, it was just a choice that I made, and I don't feel bad about it because I've come back to it now,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
And my voice has changed a lot, and I think it's gotten better with my life experience, and you know.
You sound pretty good for a 6 year old there, but it's changed a lot. So you mentioned Bessie Smith before. Who were some of the other, you know, the other singers that were important
me?
To you?
I think after Bessie Smith, I think Ella Fitzgerald was the most important, as she is for so many singers.
Right.
You know, she taught me so much, and you know, all of those songs. I think I probably learned. She recorded just about everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then Blossom Dearie was a big influence.
Really?
Yeah. And I mean, you can't necessarily hear it in my voice, but I loved Blossom Dearie. I got to see her here, actually, in New York. And Anita O'Day.
Mm.
And also a singer that was from this area, or lived in this area, named Susanna McCorkle.
Oh, yeah.
She was I was a huge fan of hers.
Yeah. You're right. I don't hear a lot of Blossom Dearie, but then I don't hear a lot of Blossom Dearie in many other singers. I mean, for folks who aren't familiar, I actually got a call from her one night while I was doing, like, you know, this whole program of avant-garde music on uh-huh. the air here, and the phone rings, and... Hello, John. This is Blossom Dearie. And I was like, I had no idea who she was. I'm like, yeah, right.
That's pretty good. That's either Blossom or Carol Channing. I can't decide.
I never make any claims being a good impersonator, but you know that kind of almost childlike voice that
yeah.
she had.
The way she could interpret songs, I mean, she didn't have this enormous range, but what she did with it, I think, was yeah. just extraordinary.
Absolutely. Molly Ringwald is my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. Let's hear the song that gives your album its title.
Okay.
The album's called Except Sometimes, but the song is called I Get Along Without You Very Well. Now, you were saying before that people record albums of standards. They choose Hoagy Carmichael. They probably go to Stardust or
uh-huh.
something like that. So
right.
you went for something that was
yeah.
not quite thrice familiar.
Well, I always thought the song was just really moving, and I just considered it to be a song about heartbreak and, mm-hmm. you know, just breaking up with someone. And what it was actually about was somebody really leaving. It was written by a woman named Jane Brown Thompson, who was a widow in Philadelphia, 70-something years old. And when I heard that, it made the song even more poignant
yeah.
for me.
The song is I Get Along Without You Very Well, Except Sometimes, from Molly Ringwald.
I get along without you very well. I do. Except except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do. But I get along without you very well. I've forgotten you just like I should. Of course I have. Except to hear your name or someone's laugh that is the same. But I've forgotten you just like I should.
Hoagie Carmichael's I Get Along Without You Very Well, Except Sometimes. The album is called Except Sometimes, from my guest Molly Ringwald, the actress, author, and musician. She's performing with this band tomorrow at Iridium at 8 and 10. As we've mentioned, the album by Molly Ringwald called Except Sometimes is a collection of songs from what is generally known as the Great American Songbook. There is one exception, and that is Don't You Forget About Me, the Simple Minds song that was at the end of The Breakfast Club, the John Hughes film. How close were you to John Hughes, who passed away in 2009?
Well, I was very close. I mean, I did three movies with him, and, you know, he wrote Pretty in Pink for me. We were born on the same day, 18 years apart, February 18th. And I think that we definitely had a very special relationship when we were working together. I mean, he was, and for the rest of our lives, I think we'll always be connected in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for the rest of my life, because he's gone now. But I think when people think of John Hughes, they think of me, and vice versa.
Right. Well, last year you had told the LA Times that while those movies you have sort of little interest in them, you appreciate what they mean to a whole generation of people who grew up on them.
Oh, absolutely.
And so what was the idea in doing this arrangement of this song that is so associated with him and with you and with those movies?
Well, when we recorded the album, because I actually recorded it a while ago and mastered it and then didn't do anything with it, because I got very busy writing books and having babies. he had just passed away, and he was very much in my thoughts. And I wanted to see if it was even possible to do a jazz version of it, sort of in tribute to him, and also as a way to integrate who I was into who I am now, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so Peter and I just started working on it in rehearsal, and he started putting these beautiful chords. I don't think there's one actual original chord in our version than in the Simple Minds song. And it just started to sound really interesting. And so that's kind of how that happened.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll wrap up with that. But let me mention, as long as you've talked about writing, there's the memoir, Getting the Pretty Back, Friendship, Family, and Finding the Perfect Lipstick. And then there's the novel called When It Happens to You, A Novel in Stories,
which just came out in paperback.
The record is Except Sometimes. Molly Ringwald, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Won't you come see about me? I'll be alone, dancing, you know it, baby. Tell me your troubles and doubts, giving me everything inside and out. Love's strange, so real in the dark. Think of the tender things that we were working on. Slow change may pull us apart. When the light gets into your heart, don't you forget about me.
That is Molly Ringwald from her new album called Except Sometimes, a collection of jazz standards with one exception, and that exception is this song, originally from the band Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me, which for a whole generation will forever be associated with the John Hughes film The Breakfast Club that starred Molly Ringwald. Now back to our voicemail for another musical guilty pleasure, this one from our listener Tina.
I'm a high school English teacher, and listening to the show tonight about guilty pleasures, my students would be shocked to learn that I'm actually a really big fan of Marilyn Manson's. My students look at me and they think to themselves, oh my God, there goes our conservative teacher. They think that I do nothing for fun, especially listen to music. It's actually pretty hilarious if you think about it.
You can confess to your musical guilty pleasure on our voicemail, 1-866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Coming up, a look at the lack of diversity behind the scenes on Broadway. And later, the classical guitarist Jason Vio performs in our studio. You won't want to miss that. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Tony Award nominees were announced last week, and one of the productions to receive multiple nods was Motown the Musical. The Broadway newcomer received 4 Tony nominations, including those for sound design and Best Leading Actress in a Musical. But these accolades aren't what makes the show stand out. For author and political analyst Kelly Goff, she joins me here in the studio. Kelly, welcome to Soundcheck.
Great to be here.
So you recently wrote for the website The Root about what makes this musical stand out for you, and what is that?
Well, aside from the great music and it making my mother feel like she was back in high school again, because she was straight up dancing in the seats, it's the fact that it has an African-American producer, Berry Gordy. Mm-hmm. And it's not the only show on Broadway this year that has an African-American producer, but it's significant because there have been so few African-American producers actually working on Broadway.
Now, Berry Gordy is, of course, Mr. Motown.
He's Mr. Motown. He's a legend. And also, his character is the star of the show.
Right,
so I should
right.
say that too.
And he wrote the book, so
yes,
it's all
yes.
very cozy. But you, in your article, you refer to Black Broadway producers not just as rare, but as Halley's Comet rare.
Yes, almost non-existent. Which
what?
I have to tell you, I approached this article and wanted to do it because I knew they were pretty rare. I didn't actually realize just how rare they are until I started working on the piece, and that's
until you rare. Were able to call all of them in like
yes.
half an hour,
and they all knew each other. Like literally, I kid you not, every single one of them would be like, "Have you talked to so and so?" And I'd say, "You know, they're on my list. Thanks
yeah.
for that."
Even with Motown the Musical, there are 3 producers. The other 2 are are white.
Yes,
but so. Why is it? Color lines have fallen.
Right,
we have a black
president.
Black president.
Yeah, I mean,
why is it so difficult to get African American producers on Broadway?
Yeah, because it is pretty telling if you think about it. Between the president and the first lady, we have just about as many African Americans in the White House as we do serving as lead producers on Broadway. You know, and I was shocked that that's how low the numbers are. But literally, Stephen Bird and Leah Jones are the only 2 African American lead producers working on Broadway.
Wow.
So the reasons are complicated and nuanced. Often with topics like this, this is certainly not a piece accusing Broadway of racism and mm-hmm, of being. Someplace that applauds discrimination. It's certainly not like that. But it is very much a who-you-know business. It is very much a networking and sort of clubby business, I think even more so than a lot of people in Broadway realize or would like to admit. It's really, I'm really going to get in trouble for saying this more than probably anything in my piece, but it's really not that different from like corporate America in a lot of ways.
Well, and I'm thinking also of like orchestras you know,
yes.
where it's been stuck at 3% African-American, yes, and Latino for years and years. And what I'm wondering is, does it reflect the audience? Now, you went to Motown the Musical.
Yes.
I would assume the audience a little more diverse than your average Broadway play, or am I wrong?
Yes, but I think that this is almost a chicken and an egg question. Because
of
one of the things I found in the piece is that when you have diverse Black producers, they tend to diversify the content you see on stage, and that tends to diversify the audience with amazing results. I mean, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof was the most successful Broadway production of 2008. Motown is very much, you know, if it continues at this pace, going to possibly become the most successful Broadway show of 2013. So there is an actual incentive there when people are willing to think outside the box. I think what often happens, and this is why I wanted to open by saying I'm not accusing, you know,
right,
Broadway of
right,
racism here, of intentional racism, but it's like a lot of other problems with diversity where people, they hire, they befriend people that they know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the people that they sort of think of. And so because unless someone's willing to think outside of the box, it continues to look like the orchestras we see and the, you know, the people
corporate
we see behind
America,
the scenes in
yeah,
corporate America.
Yeah.
And actually, just a perfect example of that, Irene Gandy, who's a Broadway legend and has been, you know, a press agent for Jeffrey Richards, many Tony Award winning productions for like 30 years. And she said, you know, I'm a press agent. That's what I do. I love it, Kelly. But she said, the reason I produced on Porgy and Bess is because Jeffrey said to me he felt it was important to see a person of color working on that production. That's the kind of out-of-the-box thinking we need, and we need more people to sort of take that initiative like Jeffrey Richards did. He deserves credit for that.
Well, and, you know, what a splendid production that was, starring Audra McDonald as Bess, the Gershwin Porgy and Bess. Here is Audra McDonald singing Summertime. Bit of George and Ira Gershwin's Summertime from Porgy and Bess featuring Audra McDonald. My guest today is Kelly Goff, the author and special correspondent for the website The Root. You can find a link to Kelly Goff's piece about Black producers on Broadway on our website at soundcheck.org. Can you explain what a producer actually does on Broadway?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that because I found myself actually asking quite a few people that question. So what I basically discovered is that there are different types of producers and they are sort of denoted by their different titles. So you'll see, you know, lead producer, senior producer, associate producer in association with
uh-huh,
all these different levels. And they're essentially producers who invest money, which is very important to shows, as we all know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are producers who are known as lead producers who actually conceptualize the project from top to bottom and also help invest or raise money. So that's why I explain in the piece that there are two African-Americans who have worked as lead producers because Stephen Bird and Aaliyah Jones, they not only find money for these productions, but they also help pick the director, the cast, approach the actors. They literally mount a production from top to bottom. But for Trip to Bountiful, their current production, they've also been aided by some new associate producers who have not worked on Broadway before, who are well-known in other avenues, such as Kevin Lyles, who's a very well-known hip-hop mogul, Marvette Brito, who is a very prominent African-American publicist. And they're stepping up and lending their names and their dollars as associate producers for this production.
Mm-hmm. But the lead producers now, do they find the theater as well?
Yes, and I'm so glad you brought that up because that has been cited as one of the key challenges to breaking into Broadway producing. I didn't know this till I began this piece, but there are three families who own the major Broadway houses.
All of them?
Most of them.
Oh, man.
Three.
Wow.
So when you talk about, I mean, you could actually argue that corporate America might be easier to break into in terms of diversity. Because, you know, what they were explaining to me, Aaliyah and Steven said, all of the stars literally have to align in terms of cast, in terms of timing, in terms of finance, in terms of the theaters, and in terms of the relationships. Because they said you could have Denzel Washington lined up to direct, George C. Wolfe lined up to direct, and you're like, yes, we're golden. We have all the money we need. And then you find out that the theater's not available.
Right.
And so, and if you don't have those relationships, then you're not in the game. I mean, that's what they said. Steven said you could be all dressed up with nowhere to go.
Right. So Steven and Aaliyah have a track record before A Trip to Bountiful. What are some of the other major productions that people would know them for?
They just did Streetcar Named Desire with Blair Underwood, Nicole Ari Parker. And before that, they did Cat on the Hot Tin Roof, which was wildly successful with Felicia Rashad, James Earl Jones, Terrence Howard, all-star cast. It was a huge success in 2008 and even won an Olivier Award when it went to London.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was their first production. That was their first Broadway production.
Stephen Bird and Aaliyah Jones, they are together their front row productions?
Front row productions.
All right. So they are two of the few black producers currently working successfully on Broadway. That is the topic of Kelly Goff's recent piece for the website The Root. She's with us here in the Soundcheck studio. How far back do we go with this problem? I mean, was this a problem at the beginning of Broadway, or was it like the Kentucky Derby where it was black jockeys forever and ever and then it suddenly stopped?
Well, black performers on Broadway and black creators on Broadway have existed essentially as long as Broadway has existed, you know, going back to right before the turn of the century with Clorindy of the Cakewalk, I believe is how it's pronounced. And then Shuffle Along was sort of the first big success in the 20s where it had black performers and also black producers. And you know, then you saw a number of musicals that were sort of trying to replicate the success of Shuffle Along, which is what we often see happen. That's why right. You have 40 different sequels in the movie theater where things blow up, right? Because people are trying to recapture that magic. But what you started to see really happen is you would continue to see black performers and not so many producers. And I think part of it's because the money became more of an issue after Shuffle Along. You know, you had the economy tank and the Great Depression. And so it became a riskier proposition. And, you know, money certainly plays a big role in this because, for instance, Steven and Aaliyah both have finance backgrounds. Steven was at Goldman Sachs for 15 years. So we know that there is less wealth in the African-American community than the white community.
Right.
And so that's kind of a starting point. But then also in terms of networking, that adds another layer of complication to it.
Well, now, you mentioned Shuffle Along, which is from 1921, and which, you know, music fans will remember as like the first coming out party, really,
yes,
for the team of Blake and Sissel. UB yes. Blake, the pianist, and
yes.
Noble Sissel, the lyricist.
And also a number of icons in that show, Josephine Baker, Paul Robeson.
Right.
The music became so iconic, Harry Truman used it on his campaign.
I'm Just Wild About Harry.
That's right.
UB Blake and the Shuffle Along Orchestra here with a song called Bandana Days. UB Blake and the Shuffle Along Orchestra, Bandana Days, from the 1921 Broadway production Shuffle Along, the first really great Sissel and Blake, or Blake and Sissel as they were known, UB Blake, Noble Sissel. And as Kelly Goff has told us, it also unleashed upon an unsuspecting world the talents of Josephine Baker and Paul Robeson. There was a black producer for this show. And then what do we have, like 60, 70 years where there's nothing?
It's sporadic, even though African Americans starred in some of the biggest hits on Broadway, like Dreamgirls, for instance,
mm-hmm.
which still wasn't produced by people of color. So, and again, you know, I want to be really clear in the tone of this conversation
because
I'm certainly not taking anything away from those productions. I mean, Dreamgirls is a legendary Broadway show and, you know, beloved by people of all races. But the producers I interviewed raised some really interesting and compelling points about why this issue matters, because I think in the age of, you know, so many serious political and racial issues, it's sort of like, well, does this really matter? And what they pointed out is that diversity behind the scenes begets diversity on the stage. And that oftentimes what will happen is that great black actors. Felicia Rashad, Nicole Ari Parker apparently actually said this to Aaliyah Jones when they worked with her in her productions. They study the classics in school just like everyone else, but they're very rarely offered the opportunity to go on stage and perform in Shakespeare and perform in Arthur Miller and Ibsen and all these shows. And it often takes someone of color to think outside the box and say, I'd consider her or him for that role. Or even things like we're talking about with the orchestra, mm-hmm. right? Where people mm-hmm. tend to hire people they know, and people who are diverse behind the scenes are more likely to consider, someone of color for stage manager or these other roles.
Well, now, you gave us before the example of Irene Gandy, this, well-known press agent yep. on Broadway who was sort of pressed into service as a as a producer for the production of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess recently. What about drawing in black celebrities from the world of music or sports or things like that? I mean, that kind of star power could be transformative.
It's starting to happen now. And really in recent years, it started to catch on, which is refreshing. Will and Jada Smith and Jay-Z co-produced Fela. Alicia Keys co-produced Stickfly. Oprah Winfrey, we all know, that shepherded The Color Purple. And so I think that it's a nice change of pace. And also the New York Knick, Tyson Chandler and his wife Kimberly actually invested as lead producers on Trip to Bountiful, which is really exciting to see an athlete step mm-hmm. up and do that. One of the things I think in our community, and this certainly came up in my conversations with these producers, I think there's a lot of pressure sometimes where you feel like if you're African-American and you've so-called made it, that you have to invest in substantive things like scholarships and the NAACP and helping kids, which are things that really matter. But the arts matter too. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I kept hearing from everyone is if we don't invest in them, who's going to? And we really have a responsibility. So that's kind of what I took away from it.
Kelly Goff's article for The Root is about black producers on Broadway. You can find a link to it on our website at soundcheck.org. Kelly, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Soundcheck. Last night on the show, we talked with songwriter, musician, and producer Brian Eno about his new audio-video installation called 77 Million Paintings. You can check out the archive of the interview on soundcheck.org. Now, like the rest of our guests this week, we asked this father of ambient music, this truly innovative and influential figure, for his musical guilty pleasure. Is there some music that you like that you don't like to admit to?
I'm not really embarrassed about any of my tastes. I'm trying to think if that's true. No, I'm afraid, John. Yeah. I have to say, whenever I tell people that I like M people, they go M people as if I've said I like dog turds. I like playing with dog turds.
You've done me wrong. Your time is up. You took a sip. From the devil's cup, you broke my heart. There's no way back. Move right out of here, baby. Go and pack your bags. Just who do you think you are? Stop acting like some kind of star. Just who do you think you are? Take it like a man, baby. If that's what you are.
M people. That's as close as Brian Eno will come to fessing up to a guilty pleasure. We'll take it. Tell us your musical guilty pleasure. Call us at 866-939-1612. We might even play it on the show later this week. We learned last night that classical guitarist Jason Vio is a secret fan of the Carpenters. Well, today he joins us with guitar in hand to play the music of Jobim and a stunning new work. Stick around. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Jason Vio is a classical guitarist. Actually,
that doesn't sound right. Let's say that Jason is a guitarist whose instrument happens to be a classical guitar, because he also plays Brazilian music, works by the jazz guitarist Pat Metheny, and on his latest CD, this Nuevo Tango music by Astor Piazzolla. He's going to start us off with a recent piece by the young American composer Dan Visconti. It's an excerpt from Devil's Strum. Here is Jason Vio live on Soundcheck. That is Jason Vio live on Soundcheck, and what the hell was that?
Yeah, it's a new piece by Dan Visconti that I'm performing a lot this season. It's really
Devil's Strum.
It's called Devil's Strum, and it's really based off of the old blues myth of the crossroads,
where, selling your soul to the devil.
That's right. Yeah. So that's where the piece starts. Actually, is where the transaction is made, and the young musician has already done the deed. And so the piece starts out actually, even in the excerpt I played, it was a little bit more kind of aleatoric or free dissonance. But in the very beginning of the piece, it starts out with a lot of that and a lot of space. And so over the course of 5 or 6 minutes, it's a very slow morph. And then the listener slowly becomes aware that that the music is changing into a blues stomp, mm-hmm. a very strong Delta blues.
So you're watching this mythical bluesman learn to use his diabolical gift.
And the music kind of represents the musician's life also kind of slowly spinning out of control. So
yeah.
The more frantic it sounds and the faster that you can play the ending, which and by the end it's like, I mean, it took me 70 hours to learn basically a 5-minute piece, because there are so many percussive things that are very specifically written, you know, written in, it's very detailed about it, that it was like learning a percussion instrument.
Well, and, you know, in addition to the actual use of the foot stomp as percussion, you're playing up. Playing the strings up where they attach to the up where they attach sense. to the pegboard there. I mean, Jason, I've seen a lot of guitar music, as you know, over
that's
the
right.
years. There's stuff in that piece I don't think I've ever seen
oh,
before.
Oh, that's great! Yeah.
What kind of reaction do you get to this?
It's actually getting really. The audiences are really enjoying it. They really seem to get it. You know, they get that it's a little tongue in cheek. That there's a very. They get that there's very much a visual. Aspect to the performance too. I mean that of course we're hearing this over the radio, but there's a lot of activity and you're seeing the hands go where they don't normally go in very quick kind of moves.
Right. And tuning and retuning strings on the fly in the middle of
the couple spots you heard, there's about five or six of those spots where you actually change the pitch while the piece is happening.
Yeah. So. Nice trick. Dan Visconti's piece, Devil's Strum, Jason Vio playing some of it here in the Soundcheck studio. So that means you need to be retuning while we talk here to get yourself back in a normal situation over there. So this piece is just part of a large repertoire of works that you've developed over the years. I mean, the classical guitar can do much more than, you know, the familiar Spanish pieces that Segovia was famous for.
True.
Did you set out to kind of, you know, did you make a conscious decision, I'm going to expand the repertoire of what's possible on this instrument?
No, not at all, actually. I just like a lot of different kinds of music. I mean, I joke around that I like about 10 artists of every genre of of pop and country or hard rock or that. But we have to forge our own path in terms of new compositions. We have to see what's out there and who's going to be enthusiastic about writing for it. It really has a great future as a performance-oriented instrument in concert, because because of two opposing forces. The fact that the guitar is well known in pop culture, every kid knows what a guitar is. But also that I think we're really in a golden age of performance. There's so many young players. I mean, I have four students in my studio at Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, and several really fine guitarists out of my program at Cleveland Institute of Music. And then not just that, just seeing what's happening in Asia and Europe, and there's more pieces being written for the guitar now than ever before.
Now, Jason, you are just back from Brazil, right?
Yeah, I flew in this morning.
And boy, are his arms tired. But South America has been another kind of Disneyland for guitarists and for you.
Again, I probably know 5 to 10% of the music, the published music that's out there, and it's just fantastic. And Brazil, I mean, I love the pop music there as well.
Well, and you know, when you talk about the greatest of the great pop musicians of Brazil, you have to talk about Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Absolutely.
And you're going to do one of his songs for us next?
Yeah, I'll play A Felicidade by Jobim, and it's arranged. The arrangement is by the French guitarist Roland Dion.
Okay. This is Jason Vio playing here for us on Soundcheck and a little bit of music from Brazil. Thank you. Wow. Jason Vio, the American guitarist, playing a Brazilian piece, a song by Antonio Carlos Jobim called A Felicidade, in an arrangement by the French guitarist and composer Roland Dien on Spanish guitar. Let's see if we can get
one. On a German-Spanish guitar.
German-made Spanish guitar. Jason, you mentioned before, you know, teaching at Curtis and in Cleveland. Do you do online teaching as well?
Yeah. Last June, I started the first online classical guitar school, subscription-based school, as part of Artist Works, which is based in Napa and was started by David Butler. He was one of the writers of the AOL interface, the America Online interface. And he retired for a while, but now he's back. And really, his great passion is music. It's really nice because what you basically do is you condense what you would say in a half an hour into about 5 minutes, and you give them a kind of a bullet point list, and then they go work on it. And 2 weeks later, they'll submit the video back. Mm-hmm. So the exchange is of course, it's different from being in the same room with somebody.
Right, right.
But the advantage to it
you can be in your pajamas, for one thing.
Well, right. Well, they don't recommend – the Artistworks doesn't recommend that for me. But the students certainly can. And the nice thing is that they get to – you know, I've done a lot of private lessons in hotel rooms and master classes. I do about 30 master classes a year. And I've noticed more and more the students get nervous, really nervous. So the nice thing about this is that you can be in your bedroom and you could take your best shot, record that, and send it.
So if folks want to study classical guitar with you, Jason Vio, they go to Artistworks?
They go to jasonvioschool.com, and that'll take you to my site. But there's all, I mean, they... The idea is that it's an academy, essentially, a music academy. Billy Cobham is the jazz drum teacher.
Yeah.
Luis Conti is the Latin percussion teacher. That's what really, when they were talking to me about it, that's what really sold me on it. I was like, wow, if these guys can have the time to do this. And it is. It's amazing how little time it takes.
Well, we're speaking with Jason Vio, and if you do want to check out his online school, you'll need to spell his last name. It's the letter V followed by all the vowels in the alphabet.
Yeah.
Jason, it's been really great having you with us. The new album sounds great, the music of Astor Piazzolla, and great set for us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. That is Jason Vio, and for the record, his last name is spelled V-I-E-A-U-X. Playing here the music of Astor Piazzolla, his Concert d'Aujourd'hui, with the chamber orchestra known as A Far Cry. You can also hear a live performance by Jason of an Allemande by Bach. A web extra, go to soundcheck.org to hear that. Okay, we've got time for one more musical guilty pleasure. Back to the voicemails.
Yeah, my guilty pleasure is It's Raining Men.
Hallelujah, it's raining men. Amen.
You know, it's by a girl group, and I'm a guy, so, you know, it's kind of weird. But I like the song. You guys can put this on later. It's cool.
It's raining men.
Yeah, it's okay to put this on the radio, listener, but I noticed you didn't tell us your name. Chicken. All right, tomorrow on the show, more of your musical guilty pleasures, plus singer Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks. Her new debut solo album is called Mother and features her versions of songs by Pink Floyd, Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam, and others. She'll talk about working with musician Ben Harper, that infamous onstage remark about President George W. Bush that changed her career in 2003, and much more. And live music from singer Aoife O'Donovan. That does it for tonight. See you back here tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.